Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Richard Ravitch has had an interesting and eventful life at the center of many storms. He helped save New York from the fiscal crisis of the 1970s. He ran the MTA and started bringing it back from the depths of the bad old days. He was chief labor negotiator for Major League Baseball when the players really started to get powerful. Wait till you hear the choice words George Steinbrenner once had for him. Wait till you hear his Ronald Reagan and Mario Cuomo stories. When Elliot Spitzer resigned as governor, David Paterson tapped Ravitch to be lieutenant governor to help right the teetering ship of state not that many years ago. And now, just for grins, something to do in his 80s, he's become a financial consultant to bankrupt Detroit. And in his free time, he has written a memoir called So Much to Do, A Full Life of Business, Politics, and Confronting Fiscal Crises. Richard Ravitch, welcome back to WNYC.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Before we get into some of these colorful old stories, you do have a political point to make in this book, a central point that states and local governments have made so many health and pension promises over the years that they can't keep, that it threatens our democracy, and you go that far. Are you talking about New York City and New York State, not just Detroit?
New York City is in better shape than most places, largely because one of the things we did after the near bankruptcy in 75 was to pass a law in Albany that required the city to budget in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles. And New York City has never had a fiscal crisis since and won't, because its recurring revenues match its recurring expenditures. And the problem everywhere else is that politicians kick the can down the road. And it's not just pension and health promises. It's all kinds of promises that we cannot afford because revenues are not growing as fast as obligations.
If someone like Paul Krugman was here, he might argue that deficit hawk Chicken Littles are always out there claiming the fiscal sky is falling because they don't actually believe in, say, Social Security and Medicare, don't believe in the public sector, kind of like Clive and Bundy. But you're a liberal Democrat who believes in the power of government to do good. So why are you so centrally concerned with debt?
Well, first of all, cities and states can't print money like the federal government can. Second of all, there's a total political disconnect between what happens in Washington with the budget, with changes in budgetary practices, in changes in tax law. There's inadequate measurement of the impact that has on state and local governments. Third of all, and most importantly, state and local governments, as I said, have incurred obligations, some of which are constitutionally or statutorily guaranteed, that are crowding out expenditures on things like education and on the public infrastructure. And you don't have to be a liberal Democrat to be worried about that. You could be a rock-rib conservative and still understand that if you cut back on pre-K education, which the states have to the tune of $500 million last year, if you don't reinvest in your physical infrastructure, you're sort of disinvesting in the future of your country.
So what do you do about it? Because, again, people say that Wall Street crashed the economy, but we're taking it out on teachers and firefighters. Is there some truth to that? The bank executives go unindicted and the bank fines are absorbed as the cost of doing business. While we all set about the earnest work of cutting retirees' pensions to save the world, there's something wrong with that picture if that's all there is to it. So what do we do that respects, let's say, the retirees in Detroit? You're a consultant to Detroit now in their bankruptcy. But deals with the underlying fiscal realities.
Well, it's not appropriate. I'm an advisor to the bankruptcy judge, and it's not appropriate for me to comment about what I share with him. However, I have to say, having read about Detroit in the papers and following it because I'm fascinated with this, I was very pleased at least to see that the ultimately the retirees apparently will get a much better share of a very small pie than was proposed in the original bankruptcy plan.
Richard Ravitch, my guest on WNYC, his new memoir called So Much to Do, A Full Life of Business, Politics, and Confronting Fiscal Crises. And we actually put a slideshow of some of the photos in the book on our webpage. So if you want to go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show and see Richard Ravitch on the job over the years with Governor Carey, Mayor Beam, good old Mayor Beam, Mayor Koch, Mayor Lindsay, Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan. There you go. For 4 years in the late 70s and early 80s, you were chairman of the MTA. You write that they were the most exhilarating 4 years of your life. Why was that?
Because I was able to accomplish something very real. I changed. I brought in a lot of professional people into the organization. I reorganized it. I put together the whole concept of having capital plans. I persuaded the legislature and the Congress to appropriate a lot of money, which enabled me to put together a $14 billion capital renewal restoration plan. And that was amidst a lot of difficult, awkward, painful moments, a source of immense satisfaction to have it. To feel you've made a difference.
That was the part of the fiscal crisis. The MTA was in such deep trouble. And the first story you tell about that, a little tongue-in-cheek, is how Governor Hugh Carey threatened the funding of public broadcasting, of all things, if you didn't take the job as head of the MTA. Want to tell that story?
Well, I was on the board of Channel 13, and it was run by Jay Islin. And Jay called me one day and said, the state's cutting its support of public television. Can you get me an appointment with the governor? So I said I would try, and I did. And Jay and I, the next week, walked over to the governor's office on 55th Street. We're in the waiting room, and the governor comes in, and he motions for me to come into his office, but tells Jay to continue sitting where he was. And he says to me, I want you to become chairman of the MTA. And I said, Gov, you got to be kidding. I ride the subways every day. You don't. He said, well, I won't see your friend until you say yes. But he didn't really mean that. And we talked for a while. I promised him I'd think about it. And then Jay came in and made a very eloquent plea, which I think ultimately had an impact on what the state did.
Saved some state funding for public television at the time. And you acknowledged at that point in your book that you were offered the job by Governor Carey and you took it as head of the MTA, not knowing much about the MTA. Do you not have to be a transit expert to run the MTA?
No. You have to have, I think, three qualities. You have to be willing to do a good job. You have to be willing to recognize the fact that you don't serve just the governor or the legislature or the mayor, but that your primary obligation is to the millions of 1,700,000 people who ride the system every day. And if you view that as your primary obligation, then you act in the job as a petitioner for resources. You lobby everybody, the mayor, the president, the Congress, the governor, the speaker of the assembly. You lobby them all to get money for the MTA. And whereas a lot of people didn't like my aggressiveness, the fact of the matter is it worked. And nobody really resented it because people in that generation of political leadership understood and respected the fact that the MTA had independent leadership.
And the politics of the moment were that Governor Carey promised riders no fare increase, and the upstate legislators promised their constituents no tax hike to bail out the city's mass transit. You wanted, which what you thought was in the public interest, both a fare hike and a tax hike.
That's absolutely right. And we got both. We got several.
And you tell the story, and I found this one really interesting, of asking to be asked at your confirmation hearing if you would raise the bus and subway fare, something a politician normally would not want to be asked because there is no good political answer. Why did you want to be asked that question?
Because
and put on
the governor and the mayor a week earlier had announced there wouldn't be a fare increase. And I knew that it was important for me to convey the message that my job was to get money and resources to run a safe subway system. So I asked to be asked that question. Even though the senator who I spoke to said, you know, we're going to confirm your deck. We don't want to embarrass you. And I said, oh, damn it, ask me the question. And he asked me, and I said, of course I'd raise the fare if I didn't have enough money to run the system safely. Well, that was, of course, the big headline. And the governor's staff didn't talk to me for months. But you have to understand, Hugh Carey was an extraordinary governor, an extraordinary human being. And a couple of weeks later at night, one night at the mansion up in Albany, he said to me, "Dick, thanks for getting me off the hook. That was a stupid damn promise that I made."
Listeners, any questions for Richard Ravitch, who has a memoir out now called So Much to Do about his days in the 70s fiscal crisis or running the MTA or as chief negotiator in labor talks for Major League Baseball or lieutenant governor after Elliot Spitzer resigned and David Patterson called him up and said, "Help, I never ran anything this big in my life. Help me run the state of New York." 212-433-WNYC for Richard Ravitch, 212-433-9692. Were you there? Do you remember the day the famous Daily News headline came out, "Ford to City, drop dead"?
I remember it very well.
Where were you? What do you remember?
Well, we had been in the process for months of trying to get the federal government to help, and the president kept resisting. When finally we had in place a system in which the public pension funds and the banks were buying MAC bonds, and we were trying to work ourselves out of an extraordinary mess that we had inherited, Ford continued to respond by talking about a profligate city that did things and spent money that no other city did. And it was at that point, it wasn't the governor's idea. Matter of fact, years later, Hugh Carey told me he thought the headline was a little unfair. But there was an unbelievably wonderful man who was editor of the Daily News at the time by the name of Mike O'Neill. And he was not only a great journalist, he loved New York. And he was kind of outraged that the president wasn't willing to sit down and at least consider some modest help. So it was he who put that headline in the Daily News. And
a federal bailout did not come, right?
No. First of all, I have to tell you, I recently had occasion to have dinner with Jim Baker, who was Secretary of the Treasury subsequently. But in 1975, I believe he worked in the White House for President Ford. And he recalled that that headline really upset them because the Daily News was the largest circulation newspaper in the city, maybe even in the country at that point. So they were all very shook up by it. But actually what happened was when push came to shove, the president did provide credit assistance to the city of New York.
Credit assistance. And you tell the story of President Ronald Reagan raising federal taxes, yes, I just said Ronald Reagan raising federal taxes, to support mass transit, which goes against everything we think we know about the mythology of Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, absolutely correct. Matter of fact, in 1979, Jimmy Carter proposed a 3-cent increase in the gas tax, and it never got out of committee. Nobody in Congress paid any attention. Ronald Reagan's elected. He proposes a 4-cent increase in the gas tax, one penny of which was to go to mass transit, and it goes through the Congress like a knife through butter. And I'm at the White House for the bill signing, and a reporter says, "President Reagan, how could you support a 4-cent increase in the gas tax when you got elected president on a platform of no new taxes?" And President Reagan looked at the reporter and said, "It's not a tax, it's a user charge."
Ronald Reagan, ever the politician, not just the pure ideologue that some of the people who hold him up as a hero today see him to be, right?
Correct.
212-433-WNYC. To talk to Richard Ravitch, 212-433-9692. Jim in the Bronx, you're on the air. Hi, Jim.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Okay.
My question for him is, for Richard, is having seen where the city's been, I mean, very few people have their perspective in the 70s and the doom and the no ridership to where, you know, the record numbers of ridership today. I'm just historically, if he has a personal opinion as to what the turning point was. You know, some people argue it was the Giuliani years, I'm just curious because, you know, I being here in the, from the 70s on, you know, if you take a step back, it's remarkable, the days of graffiti, the days of crime, to boom ridership. What his perspective is as to what the change was, the magic pivot in New York. Thank you.
Thank you.
You know, I've thought about that a lot, and I'm not sure I have a have the answer, but the conclusion I have come to over the years is New York is an extraordinary incubator. It continues to be a place that people from all over the world want to come to. And to get an education, I mean, we have a million kids in studying in institutions of higher learning. It is an incubator for jobs in the financial world, in the entertainment world, in the communication world.
I heard a stat last night. New York has more college students than Boston has people.
I think that's well possible. So it's an exciting, vibrant place to live. And in the 70s, we were adjusting to a couple of real changes over which government had really no control. One was really the enormous growth of programs under the Great Society that provided help to poor people, which required a very dramatic increase in the number of employees of the city of New York to administer those services. Two, it was a collapse of the private sector and loss of private employment because our industrial base, as everybody knows, has been shrinking in the United States quite significantly for a long time, and it shrunk first in big cities like New York where expenses were greater. And third of all, you had enormous in-migration of a lot of poor people from the South and from Puerto Rico, and the society hadn't yet digested that fundamental demographic change in the city. But all of that became less important as the city matured, as the city government paid a lot of attention to the crime rate and reduced it significantly. It maintained its fiscal probity throughout all of this period, and it continued to invest adequately in its infrastructure because we've had a lot of responsible mayors, and that's why we recovered from 9/11 with the dispatch with which we did too. So this is a great city, and it can survive all politicians.
Judy on the Upper West Side, I think, has a question about a whole other aspect of your career. Judy, you're on WNYC.
Hi, gentlemen. He needs to write a book.
He just wrote a book. That's why he's here. It's called So Much to Do, A Full Life of Business, Politics, and Confronting Fiscal Crises.
Thanks for repeating it. Sorry about that. Well, I flew for Pan American, and I watched Ray Grebe be brought in as a strike breaker and a union buster. Was he involved in baseball when you were there? I think he was. And would you comment on those tactics and what you can add to that info, please?
I'm sorry, I don't remember the name Ray Grebe.
Okay.
What did he do, Judy? I don't know
well,
that name
either.
Well,
he was very much a union buster, real tough.
Was he a lawyer?
No, I think he might have been, but very always hired by the corporate side.
All right. Jump in wherever you want.
Baseball strike was...
this is the 1994
baseball strike.
The only year the World Series was ever canceled, right? Because they were on strike at the time.
That is correct. And the issue was the baseball owners, or a number of them, not all of them, wanted to have an economic system that obtains in both basketball and football, which is that the media revenues get shared equally by the teams to ensure that payrolls are more competitive. So they wanted to take away the enormous advantage that the clubs in large media markets had, like New York, and distribute the proceeds differently. And it was a battle in which the unions were on the side of those owners who didn't want to change anything.
Because without a revenue sharing agreement, there would be no salary cap.
That's
and
right.
The best players could still make the sky's the limit salaries.
That's correct.
And one person who does not come off well in your book is the late Yankees owner George Steinbrenner. You have two little Steinbrenner anecdotes. In the first one, you're working for Governor Carey in the late 70s, trying to get the 1984 Summer Olympics for New York. Can you tell us the Steinbrenner story around that?
Well, we worked very hard to put together a plan. I presented it to the governor and the mayor and included the proposal that we would open up the bleacher end of Shea Stadium to make it elliptical. And the governor,
because the Olympics required a facility like that.
That's correct, to run the 880. I pointed out to the governor that if we were the successful bidder, if New York were to prevail, which we ultimately didn't over Los Angeles, but that the Mets would have had to play in Yankee Stadium for two summers. And I suggested that he call Mr. Steinbrenner. And he told me to make the call. And I said, well, I didn't know Mr. Steinbrenner. And the governor said, well, he'll probably take your call anyway. So I did put in the call, and I explained it all to him. And his response was not exactly particularly polite or warm. And so when I called the governor,
I think you wrote in the book that he told you to perform a physically impossible act.
Right. And when I reported that to the governor, he laughed. He said, why do you think I wanted you to call him?
And the second one had to do with Gene Autry, Ronald Reagan, and that Major League Baseball salary cap or revenue sharing when you were the labor negotiator.
Well, he was dead set against it, and Gene Autry, the singing cowboy, was who owned the Los Angeles Angels, was all in favor of it. And Steinbrenner was mocking the incompetence of the ownership of the Los Angeles Angels at an owner's meeting. And Gene Autry was standing in the back of the room with tears running down his face. And when I asked him why, he told me that when George Steinbrenner had been convicted of a felony after
illegal campaign contributions to the Nixon reelection campaign,
correct, that subsequently Mr. Steinbrenner asked his great baseball buddy, Gene Autry, to intervene with President Reagan, who was a very close friend of Gene Autry's, and he did, and Mr. Steinbrenner was pardoned. So Gene Autry thought,
restoring his right to vote, by the way.
That is correct. And without commenting on the rightness or wrongness of the pardon, it was at least very hurtful for Gene Autry after having extended himself for his pal Steinbrenner in that regard to listen to a half an hour of abuse.
So George Steinbrenner made cowboy Gene Autry cry, revealed in the unlikely place of Richard Ravitch's political memoir, So Much to Do. William in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Mr. Ravitch. Hello. William, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
What's your question?
My question is, when New York was on the verge of bankruptcy in the middle 70s, and Felix Rowetten came up with a plan to save the city by issuing bonds, pledging the real estate in New York City as collateral, I wondered whether you were involved with him at all in that endeavor.
Oh, very much so. And it was actually the sales tax was taken away from the city and paid to the Municipal Assistance Corporation, because we had to convert all of the short-term debt that was maturing every month into long-term debt because the city's cash position could not sustain the continuation of the practices that the city had been engaged in.
We're almost out of time. You make a sweeping statement on politics that I really like and that I think is much less cynical than what we usually hear. You write that to accomplish your political goals, you have to engage in a degree of manipulation, but to a surprising extent, it's about treating people with the decency you would wish for yourself. That's a quote from your book. Can you really get ahead in politics by being a stand-up guy, by being a mensch?
You know something, if people don't try, then this downward spiral of political polarization a cultural attitude that says politics is a dirty thing, politician is not a dignified profession. If that continues, democracy's in serious trouble, because the only way anything ever changes in a democracy is through politics. And therefore, even though all of the changes exist and all these dreadful Supreme Court decisions which prevent limitations on the amount of private money that can go into politics, despite all of that, I think we're going to see a renaissance. I think we're going to see a younger generation that's going to react to all of the inequalities and problems in the society and get involved in politics again.
What would bring that revolution about? What would bring those young people, uncynical young people, in?
A recognition that the only way they could change things is by getting involved in politics. I ran for office once. I was a dreadful candidate, but the experience was exhilarating.
For mayor, right?
Yes. And I wasn't any good at it, but I thought it was a great experience, and I encourage young people all the time to try.
Richard Ravitch's memoir called So Much to Do, A Full Life of Business, Politics, and Confronting Fiscal Crises, and he's not done yet. Keep it up. Thank you very much.
Thank you.